So, may we start?
1, 2, 3, 4! So may we start? It's time to start.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to the Third Act Podcast, episode number 196. I'm your host, Christian Estabrook. With me, as always, is Jericho Serrona.
Christian, we're talking Papa Panahi tonight, but what do you pair with a panini? Tomato soup or sweet potato fries?
Oh my gosh. Listeners, of course, we want to remind you that all of us here at the Third Act Podcast, we watch a lot of films. We have a lot of opinions on those films, and we're just pretentious enough to think that you care. A lot of alliteration there. That's kind of our bread and butter. I like that. We are calling this episode Papa and Pana Panahi, which has even more alliteration. What do you pair with a panini?
You got to answer the question.
Probably potato fries. I think that sounds nice.
So I don't like sweet potato fries, so I'm a tomato soup guy all the way on this one. If those are the two options, there's obviously other things, macaroni salad. There's all kinds of things you can pair with the panini, but between the two. And also, I have an intolerance to potatoes, so it's a no-brainer for me, Christian. Oh. But I'm going to put you down for sweet potato fries. So that's one and one.
I didn't know you didn't hang with potatoes. I'm sorry to hear that. Potatoes are a must around.
I love potatoes. I mean, I've only known this for a couple of years, the last couple of years, because I actually had some testing done and that dietary stuff. But before that, I was eating potatoes all the time. Fries, potato chips.
Is that like gluten related? Is it like a celiac type thing? Because potatoes all starchy. Is that why? Is that what it's connected to?
Yeah, it's not. I don't have celiacs. I was tested for that too. It's not gluten. I'm not allergic to gluten. It's just so it's not an allergy. Huh. It's just an intolerance. I have no patience for potatoes, Christian, and I can't stand for them. I'm just intolerant.
Intolerant. Got it. Interesting. I haven't heard that. Well, I mean, you're also, Jericho, you're dropping this panini thing on me now. I don't know how long you've been sitting on this. We like our alliteration. We like our goofy episode titles. We could have been eating paninis and talking panahi tonight. Mm-hmm. That could have been a panini and panahi night. But alas, I'm not prepared. I just had the grilled chicken. That's all I had. No panini.
Well, the listeners went out because otherwise they would hear us crunching on Italian bread and cheese into the mics. So I don't think there's going to be any love lost there. Yes. But Christian, I mean, this is a big episode. Are we still on this?
Oh, sorry. This is a big episode. Why is it a big episode?
It's a big episode because we're talking Iranian cinema, and we didn't like really forecast this, but everything that's been going on culturally in Iran, I mean, I think this, I'm not saying our podcast episode is important in the grander scheme of things,
heaven
but
forbid.
It's I think it's a good thing. I think we're going to be spotlighting some films from that area that should be spotlighted. So let's do that, shall we?
You know, I didn't even put that together. I don't know why my brain did not even connect those dots. I was reading an article earlier today about Iran and the protests and the revolution that's happening there, and watched a couple of Iranian films in the last 24 hours and didn't even connect. Hey, that's noteworthy.
Wow.
I don't know why that didn't even cross my mind for whatever
reason. You're really out to lunch here.
A panini lunch, even.
You're
I guess,
dreaming of paninis.
Well, I don't know. I guess, you know, we're big fans of Iranian cinema around here. And I feel like we take opportunities to talk about Iranian cinema semi-regularly, and it usually does us well to do so. So I was thinking of it as far as the film watching diet, you know, disconnected from anything else. I didn't even go there logically for whatever reason. But yeah, we should dig in. Absolutely, we should dig in. Real quick, I feel like I do need to do a mea culpa here. I did artificially bloat the last two episodes of the podcast. I know the controversy's mm-hmm. out there. I know the complaints are out there. I know attempts to cancel me are catching fire. I just, you know, I want to apologize and I want to own up to my mistakes. This is not a Kyrie Irving moment where I'm going to like skirt around it or say I did not make the film. How could I be? How could I be the one at fault here? That's not going to be that. I know I own up to it. It's my fault. I accidentally left like 30 seconds of audio at the 2 hour mark in GarageBand and made both files way too big. So our episodes, last two episodes were about an hour long, one a little over, one a little less, I think. But then there's about 60 minutes worth of dead air until you can hear our theme song again. So noted. It might happen again. I'll do my best to see that it doesn't. But I apologize. I own up to my mistakes.
At least throw like a bonus track in at the end of the 2 hour mark, something different. But Christian, I mean, artificial bloatgate is trending. I mean, this is really blown up. I mean, it's even more divisive than the conversation around Blonde a couple weeks ago. The listeners, were very upset. They saw the length when they downloaded the episode, because we know everyone downloads episodes, right? And they saw, oh, 2 hours, 2.5 hours. I'm going to be able to clean my toilet. I'm going to be able to go on jogging and listen to the episode. Absolutely. I'm going to be able to sit down, eat a panini, whatever. And
right.
You get to the hour mark, the episode's over. Artificial bloatgate. I mean, you are owning up to it, so I'll give you that. Listeners out there, if you want us to actually bloat the episodes, legitimate bloat, we can do that for you.
We'll do our best.
And yeah, so just let us know in the comment section. Subscribe, like, send us messages. I mean, interact with us. Are you out there?
Is anybody out there? All right. So that's the apology portion of the podcast. Hopefully I can apologize about something next episode as well. But that is for another day's business. So we're calling this episode Papa and Pana Panahi. Of course, Jafar Panahi, quite heralded Iranian filmmaker, I believe. We've touched on some of his films in some shape or form over the years. I believe This Is Not a Film, Closed Curtain, and Taxi have all, even if they weren't full reviews, I believe those were all brought up at different points. Maybe another one if I might have missed one, but I think that's the ones we've covered, and I think they are generally well-liked films. And then his son had a directorial debut this year called Hit the Road. That's Pana Panahi. I apologize if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly. I guess two apologies this episode. So we figured, hey, why not talk about Pana Panahi's debut film and take that as an opportunity to talk about one of Papa Panahi, Jafar Panahi's films in his filmography that we haven't touched on. He actually has a new film as well, Jafar Panahi does. It's not available quite yet. I don't know if it's going to be distributed before the end of 2022. I know it played festivals and things like that. So we may have another chance to visit the Panahi conversation here shortly, but we decided to check out Pana Panahi's film Hit the Road and then head back to the archives for Jafar Panahi's 2003 film Crimson Gold. So a new release, Panahi, and a Panahi from the vaults. Jericho, I know we've touched on it a little bit. Any Panahi thoughts as we're kind of getting things started here. Like I said, it's not someone we've done too deep of a dive, but I feel like he's come up every so often. Jafar Panahi, and is someone we like, yourself, myself, and Armando, if you were with us.
Oh, yeah. And I remember Armando specifically really being in on This Is Not a Film. I want to say that made it something. Yeah. And that was the our first year of the podcast. So, yeah. And I think you talked about Taxi at one point. So he's been mentioned on our show in various forms, but we've never actually done like a full legitimate review of one of his movies, I don't believe. And yeah, I'm a fan. I've seen a couple other of his films, and Panahi is a prince, Christian, to use another alliteration. He's a prince. Big fan. And also, as we know from other Iranian filmmakers like Asghar Farhadi and Abbas Kiarostami, these guys making art outside the confines of the government, so often leading to fines, jail time, house arrest. I mean, they're really doing everything they can to continue to create under extremely difficult circumstances. So I feel like any time Panahi, or in this case, the young son, Panahi, is able to make anything and actually get it distributed and get it out there is something to celebrate. It's something to look forward to because of what's going on in Iran, even at this moment. So I was really excited to check out Hit the Road for sure and go back and look at Crimson Gold.
Yeah, it's been, a tumultuous journey, to say the least, for Jafar Panahi's films. He's been arrested multiple times. The Jafar Panahi film we're talking about was never even released in Iran because of its subject matter. It was banned from release, which also made it like ineligible for things like the Oscars. Like, it couldn't officially run in the best foreign film, for that award because it was never officially released in its home country, things like that. So there's all sorts of, kind of stories and tribulations behind all sorts of his films. So knowing that a little bit, I was also excited to check out Panahi's debut, Hit the Road, and see if there's some similarities in style or theme or what was going on there. So it seemed like something definitely worth talking about. Came out stateside earlier this year. It is on streaming services now. You can rent it or you can watch it for free if you have a Prime Video subscription. So easy to catch up with Hit the Road. This one, of course, written and directed by Panah Panahi. It stars Pantea Panahiha, Mohammed Hassan Majuni, and Rayan Sarlak. The synopsis: it follows the chaotic, tender family that is on a road trip across a rugged landscape and fussing over the sick dog and getting on each other's nerves. Only the mysterious older brother is quiet. Kind of an enigmatic synopsis there from IMDb, but maybe it's appropriate for the film. So kind of a road movie, as the title might lead you to believe, a little bit of a road trip type thing, but maybe different than a lot of road trip movies. I don't know. I guess that kind of sets up the plot, especially since some of the reasons behind this family being in the car for so long are kind of held from us for a good chunk of the film. There is kind of an air of mystery to it, I think. I'm curious to know at some point in the conversation how important you think that is to the kind of effectiveness of the film, not really knowing what's going to happen or if that should be clear right away, even though it's not actually stated out loud. Anyway, I'm rambling. Hit the Road from Panah Panahi. Jericho, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well, Christian, when you think of Iranian cinema, you think somber, austere, like really you think about resistance, right? I mean, since filmmaking is more or less controlled by the government there, as I was saying earlier, any piece of art that's made outside of those confines, especially if they're challenging social norms, is automatically going to be considered transgressive or most likely banned. So you got guys like Abbas Kiarostami, like Oscar Farhadi, like Jafar Panahi that understand this. They're no strangers to this. I mean, we talked about this is not a film. That was actually made while Panahi was under house arrest. And with everything currently going on in Iran right now, there's something very sobering about watching this film because of the fact that Panahi was able to get his first feature out there to audiences where you can go and watch this film on Amazon Prime right now is itself, I think, an act of courage. But does the film stand on its own apart from maybe the cultural or political importance of it existing? I think it does. I think Hit the Road is a really good film. Is it a great film? I'm not sure, but it's really, really good. And a lot of why it's good for me comes with the element of surprise of not going in, not knowing anything about it. I was really not expecting as much humor as we got here. I mean, for a large stretch, this is really plays like a straight up comedy, you know, albeit absolutely a comedy that's it's tinged with uncertainty and a sense of tension, since we don't know why this family is traveling in their car heading for the border. And information comes out gradually. But what matters, of course, is the journey, right? Not the destination or even the reason to reach the destination, which I think is something that you were asking. Like, how important is it that we know the reasoning for this road trip? For me, this becomes more about how each member of this family deals with what's going on. You have the mother here, clearly having a tough time keeping her emotions in check when it comes to her elder son, Farid, while the father spends most of his time cracking jokes, berating their younger son, who's like fairly impulsive and at times annoying, just kind of just this firecracker of a little pipsqueak. And the simple setup where a bunch of characters are trapped together inside a car for most of the running time, it harkens to other Iranian films like Kiarostami's Taste of Cherry, which also involves people heading to an important destination, or Papa Panahi, Jafar Panahi's Taxi.
Sure.
The characters drive around aimlessly and we're forced to concentrate on the conversations themselves rather than any kind of overriding plot. And that plotlessness is also a key factor in this film. We get an encounter with a marathon bike racer. There's an impromptu karaoke session. There's sheepskin shopping and various stops along the way where Panahi allows the wide vistas and these long static shots to take over. There are a few stunning long take shots here, Christian. Yeah. One involves a heavily foggy road with an emerging motorcycle. And there's a later one, which is kind of like the major scene most people are probably going to reference when they think of this film, that takes place in an extreme wide shot set against a gorgeous backdrop at
sunset. It's a showstopper.
Yeah. And that specific shot and scene reminded me of a similar visual from the African film Timbuktu. I don't know if you ever saw that, Christian, but that's kind of, I was reminded of that film a lot with that one sequence. And what's happening in the sequence is really important from a character standpoint, from a thematic standpoint, but Panahi just lets it play out in this very look at me ostentatious kind of shot, but it's so gorgeous and stunning that I think it kind of overrides maybe the attention it's drawing to itself, because it's, I mean, it's such an incredible shot. And the first half is definitely more comedic and domestic. The final third, though, is more melancholic. It's eerie. It's more universal. Maybe some of the aesthetics here feel a bit stagey or contrived. You don't get the raw, like, docu-realism of Jafar Panahi's films or some of these other Iranian films that feel really gritty and close to the ground. This actually favors the kind of art house visuals that are more in line with like A24 films than typical yeah. Iranian cinema that's that true. We see. It does feel like a younger person's film. And I do like that.
It feels very modern. I think you mm-hmm. watch, you know, Farhadi or Panahi, you watch some of these other filmmakers coming from the same geographical place. And there's something kind of classic about a lot of those mm-hmm. films that feel like they could have really been made at any time. Like this could have been something dusted off from the 70s. Obviously, there's like modern technology in some of them, but there's nothing in a lot of those films. There's really nothing that announces it as something new or modern or like pushing the envelope in any way. And, you know, I think you're kind of teasing that there's one sequence in particular. I don't even know, you know, not that we should be nervous about spoiling Hit the Road, I suppose, but there is one really surprising sequence from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it just shows that, you know, that young Panahi here is absorbed some more recent influences and in films that maybe he's grown up with, American films perhaps, or art house films, and that classical neo-realistic bent that his father and others in Iran might have is not really here, and yet the same kind of sparse, patient style is here. But getting back to what happens in the film, why does Farid need to leave Iran? He's definitely haunted. He's tormented by something. There's references to quarantine, the family, and the family not being able to see him again after reaching the border. But why is that? The answer, I don't think, is that relevant to answer your earlier question. Mm-hmm. What matters here is the systematic kind of bureaucratic systems which make life nearly unlivable in Iran, which is a clear link, I think, to some of Farhadi's cinema. If you think of especially A Separation comes to mind, the fear these characters have given the social and class structures and how morality intertwines, it's broached in this film, even if on the surface the movie doesn't really seem to be about any of that stuff. But I really enjoyed the performances, all of them, except for the kid, it was hit and miss. I love the spare style. The humor mostly worked for me as well. But it was the melancholy, like eerie sort of atmosphere that takes over in the latter half that definitely lingers, Christian. So I'm kind of teetering on between the good and the great on this one. Sure. Maybe like a rewatch. There's definitely great moments. There's definitely kind of staggering scenes here and things that were really emotional and really heartfelt. But it's still kind of hanging around there. Just can't quite nudge it up. But will you, Christian, will you nudge it? Will you say this is a wow film?
I mean, it is not a wow film on the scale of what this film references as the greatest film the world has ever made. I don't think. If you recall, Jericho, do you recall the greatest film ever made according to Hit the Road?
Was it 2001?
It was, yeah, 2001.
Was it? Yeah. Oh, right, the conversation between the mother and the son, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, which I did like that. It kind of came out of nowhere. I was like, oh, okay, we're talking about 2001 for a moment. I can hang with this. So it doesn't quite hit those heights. I mean, does it hit the heights of other, you know, humorous, somber, cramped in a car, you know, road trip movies like Little Miss Sunshine? Maybe that's a more...
the Iranian Little Miss Sunshine. the little kid in this is basically the Paul Dano character from that movie, except he talks more.
No. The older brother is Paul Dano, and the kid is more annoying Abigail Breslin.
Clearly, you've seen Little Miss Sunshine more than me.
The dog is Steve Carell, I think, or Alan Arkin. I don't know. Anyway, I'm going to stop. I mean, I'm of course being facetious, but that is sincere. I did think of Little Miss Sunshine while watching this. Something about those earlier, you know, the first act humorous scenes while being, you know, in this, you know, overstuffed, you know, family vehicle for so long, that did come to mind naturally. Over my experience with Hit the Road. So there's definitely a lot to like with Hit the Road. I think that honestly, you know, and if you have artists and filmmakers, things like that, that are related, sometimes it, you know, might be annoying or a little too easy to do direct comparisons to them. But I actually think I like Hit the Road more when directly comparing it to Jafar Panahi's work, not because I prefer it, but because I like seeing the distance between them. I like seeing the different perspectives on maybe similar ideas or, you know, socio-political kind of concepts. I think they are both, even though Hit the Road does have this more mysterious kind of angle to it, I think they're both social filmmakers, and the different ways, the different storytelling ideas that are, you know, that are deployed to kind of explore those themes, those ideas, I think is really interesting in comparison. I also think that Panahi does some really interesting things. Some of them are a little bit showy, as you hinted at before, but this is a road trip movie. I think most of the runtime is in the vehicle that the family is all in. But I don't feel like this is a claustrophobic movie. I actually think that it feels more kind of expansive than some of Jafar Panahi's films that I've seen, even though those take place in more locations and aren't as literally confined in kind of the sets and locations of where those films are. Something about this, I don't know, I guess it's the vistas and it's those wide shots that are lingering with me more than kind of the cramped car that they're in, which I was not expecting. And not even expecting immediately after watching it, but like, as I'm recalling it, it's the wider shots, the kind of the view of everything surrounding them, and even just the wide open space that's able to be captured. A lot of the other Iranian films that I've seen feel like they're in kind of metropolitan areas. There's always people around. There's like tight living quarters, and it just seems like more heavily populated or cramped, where I don't know. I don't have an immediate comparison for something in Iranian cinema that has this much space to it. Even simple things, like there's shots from the car where like the kid is taking the dog to go pee, and you can like see the kid like way in the background of the image, like small and out of focus, but there's like a depth to the frame there, even though there's not a lot happening, there's not a lot of movement, there's still that depth that's present. Speaking of pee, Jericho, if I'm picking up any other languages here, I don't know, I'll probably start saying pee in Persian or whichever language they're speaking here pretty easily, because I had never could have guessed that pee would come up so many times in one 93-minute movie. It's constant pee references, jokes, conversation, setting up for one of the scenes of the film where the three of them are all giggling to each other while the older brother is driving the car silently and crying. And of course I'm watching the subtitles, and the subtitles like, you know, the dog's pee and my pee, and if you take this pee from these photographs, it'll be art, the pee of so and so. Just like, all right, this is not the kind of sequence I would have expected from this. But I guess that's some of the boldness of this, though, is that it does have this kind of baser, you know, humorous element and kind of streak to a lot of this movie, even though it can feel pretty weighty and somber through large stretches as well. So it's kind of a balance that's attempted to be struck. I will say, maybe surprisingly, as the father of the podcast here, not of the podcast, but on the podcast, not a big fan of this kid, I gotta say. I think he's supposed to be annoying on purpose, but for a 90-minute film where there's a lot of his like shrieking and joking and his antics, it is not, I don't know, it is not enjoyable to spend that much time with this kid. And I think, I don't know, I think to some degree he's supposed to be annoying, but I think there's supposed to be a cute factor as well. And I don't think that, for me, the performance tapped enough into the cute as it did the annoying. That maybe was the what I perceived to be the intended effect. I think so maybe. Christian, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, I didn't interrupt you there. There's a couple scenes here of them going out to the desert to bury cell phones. So you're saying keep the cell phone, bury the kid.
more or less, that is what I'm saying. I don't know. I get the impression that, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but even like the poster, right? It's like the kid like through the sunroof, like screaming and smiling. I think it's meant to be like this really like joyous, happy, like see, like experiencing some of the movie through the younger brother's experience and eyes, and his energy is supposed to be part of like the positive experience of watching Hit the Road. I'm not sure if that quite hit for me, to be honest. I don't know if I want to bury him. I don't know if I'm not torching the kid here, but I don't know. It's a little much, honestly. If you know, I think you're a little bit warmer on this, but if you're on like the good to great border here, I feel like the kid might keep it just shy of greatness. That's my take, at least. Not trying to be too harsh here, all right? I'm trying to be respectful, but I think that's where I'm landing.
I mean, that's all fair. I mean, the kid was a bit rough, hard to take, but I think the last half of the film, I feel like there's less of them. And when the film moves away from kind of the domestic comedy, it gets more, I don't want to say serious, but it definitely takes on an eerier kind of haunting feeling. I think a lot of the kid's antics are kind of blurred into the background. And I mean, just for some of these tableaus alone, I mean, the film is worth seeing just for that. But yeah, I could have done without. They didn't even, I mean, what purpose did the kid really serve other than to like aggravate and annoy the parents?
Yeah, I think it's just to keep things light in an otherwise heavy movie, right? Like he's joking, he's laughing, he's eating snacks, he's, you know, getting kind of like pushed around by the dad in the back seat. You have the arguing with him and his cell phone and the pee conversation. He's drinking out of the biker's water bottle, like all these little, you know, not laugh out loud things, but things to kind of keep the tone lighter. I think that's why he's there. I really like that that scene where they pick up the biker.
I'm a fan of the biker gag. That was good.
That's kind of some like awkward, there's like some kind of like awkward humor to that where things just feel a little unsettled in the conversation that they have, and the way he like, you know, just jumps into the car and then leaves the car seemingly healed from his injury. I don't know, something about all of that was really fun. And then when the parents say that it was like a mistake for them to keep the whole thing that they explain about how the dog is on its last legs and they tried to get rid of the dog, but then the dog didn't die. And so, oh, maybe they can give the dog to the cyclist and have him take the dog so the kid won't see the dog die. Very dark, but I thought that was a pretty funny interaction as well. Like, what do you mean? What are you going to tell the kid if I leave with the family dog? I dog napped? Is that what you're wanting the explanation to be? I thought that whole sequence was a highlight of the film, in kind of the writing and the setups that were explored. I thought that was really good. Also, I mean, this is mostly a kind of family drama. We talked in the first half. There's definitely some, you know, moments of punctuated comedy. Looking for some other things, there's also a little bit of, you know, fantasy. And I got to say, you know, looking at where is Panahi getting influences from, it also feels like a horror movie in brief glimpses. I think the masked motorcyclists kind of happening upon certain scenes seemingly out of nowhere. There's like a menace to the film that I feel like there's like a tone shift that kind of comes out of nowhere, but really successfully for me kind of added an element of danger to the interaction without even knowing for sure if that's what the dynamic was, but like a heightened the tone shift, and it was a kind of in this I was in a more heightened, you know, position watching it, kind of curious about how that could play out. So I thought like the way he was able to shift tones so quickly from one thing to the next was impressive, and got to a kind of a darker place at times as well.
It's elevated horror, Christian.
Big fan
of the sheep, the sheepskin salesman guy.
Yeah,
big fan of that guy. He was great. But yeah, this is two recommendations though. I would tell people to see this. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely a recommendation, for sure. It's solid. It's a solid debut from the Junior Panahi. Let's go back in time though a little bit. Let's go back to 2003 for Jafar Panahi's film Crimson Gold. This one stars Hossein Emadeddin, Kamyar Shaisi, and Azita Reyeshi. The synopsis: an Iranian pizza delivery man sees the worst of corruption and social imbalance in his city and is driven to crime. Another interesting synopsis here. I guess that's all true. It's an interesting way to explain it. And we've been talking about these two Panahis, Jericho, but also talking a little bit about our exposure to Iranian cinema. I think it's also worth noting this one written by Abbas Kiarostami.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it gives it an automatic one-star bomb just for Kiarostami's contributions here.
Yeah, so
two heavyweights of Iranian cinema working on a film together. I mean, that was the immediate thing that stuck out to me in kind of highlighting this one for a review, because we had a couple different options.
We did, yeah.
From his past catalog, I guess. And I always heard this one was a real big deal. So decided we'd rectify that on this show.
And I think we can confirm it is a pretty big deal. What the synopsis says is, you know, so our lead character, the actor is named Hossein, the character is named Hossein. The opening scene of the film is a robbery of a jewelry store. And then we cut back in time, I think about 2 days before that. And we spend some time with that character who was holding up the jewelry store. And we see a little bit of his life. There's some interaction with some other characters, kind of testing out the degree to which they could be successful thieves and or pickpockets. But his job on the up and up is to deliver pizzas, and there's kind of some mini vignettes, I suppose, but this is not a heightened film, I don't think, really in any way. It is very withdrawn. It's very quiet. This is getting into that, you know, very neorealist type perspective where you see this character just have these somewhat banal conversations and kind of interact with other people where there's not a lot going on the surface, but it all has the impact of to insofar as it kind of, I don't know, I guess the part that I'm trying to like kind of parse through, like the synopsis says, sees the worst of corruption and social unbalance in his city and is driven to crime. That sounds epic, right? That sounds like that sounds like a gangster movie. You know what I mean? This sounds like Goodfellas or something like that. That's what that like conjures to me, is this really like intense storytelling or this really dramatic, you know, character piece that we're going to be exploring. But most of the time it's, you know, him standing outside of a building waiting for a party to end and offering slices of pizza to a soldier and some cops, and them kind of having, you know, I don't know, even the conversation, it's not like the dialogue is like these heavy monologues or kind of composed in a certain way that, you know, there's a punch packed into each, you know, kind of line delivery, things like that. It just kind of washes over you, but the impact is still there, where you kind of feel the weight of it, where, you know, he has, we know that Hossein has a past in the military, and things obviously didn't go well for him. We see that highlighted in a couple different ways, like he delivers pizza and someone recognizes him. They have this conversation and clearly the guy kind of pities him. He offers him a much larger tip once he kind of recognizes who the person is that he's talking to. He has a conversation with this young soldier who's like a teenager, and there's just, like in between the lines of dialogue, in between what's actually spoken, it just seems like there's all this weight of what this guy experienced, what's going on in this location at this point in time that people are having to suffer through, and these horrible experiences that people are kind of dragged through, how that's really used and abused this guy in particular. And he's reminded of those injustices. He's reminded of these imbalances just in his everyday interactions. And sometimes it's, you know, relatively minor, or, you know, seemingly minor, like him going to a jewelry store and not being invited inside because he looks more, you know, lower or working class compared to the jewelry store's original people, the jewelry store's normal kind of patrons. But sometimes it's more dramatic as well, where you have actual death and violence that he experiences and then has to go deliver pizzas to this rich guy's house. And you have these scenes where he's shaving or just standing in these huge rooms that look unlike any other set that we've seen in the film and likely he's ever come across as a character in his, you know, day-to-day life. It's doing so much just through depiction without even kind of explaining the contrast or even calling attention to it outside of just showing it. Like, you'll have a long, you know, relatively long 20 seconds or whatever, 30 seconds of him sitting in his apartment that's pretty dingy. You hear some kind of squeaks of, you know, possibly rodents or something like that in his apartment. He's just sitting there for a while. And then shortly thereafter, he's in this rich guy's basically kind of a mansion for the area that he's in. And just seeing this character in one place to the other has all the impact without having to explain anything further than that. I guess this is, you know, kind of the benefits or qualities of showing something in this, you know, near kind of docuseries realist type way, where there isn't a lot to the narrative here. There isn't a lot to the dialogue or to the characters. It's just merely kind of showing what this guy is experiencing on a day-to-day basis and the kind of toll that that has on him. Especially given the little bit that we know about his backstory and what he may have experienced. Another wrinkle to this, I don't know if there's much you and I can say about this, Jericho, or what to say. The character at moments clearly seems to be having some mental health struggles, and the actor, you know, quote unquote actor who's playing him, is not a professional actor. He really is a guy named Hossein that was a pizza delivery man. And in real life, he suffered from schizophrenia. And I watched this shortly before recording, so I didn't have a ton of time for research, but I did look it up because I was curious a little bit if I knew any of these actors or what else they did. And I saw that he was schizophrenic in real life, and that led to like a really difficult production where some of the things he did on set and while they're trying to make the movie were disruptive and made it so that it was difficult to make the film at all, to get to the final product that we ended up getting. I don't know. I don't really know what to say to that as far as if that's, I guess to some degree it is exploitative by definition. I don't know. I don't really know how to, I don't know if I'm equipped to kind of pass any judgment or make any kind of bold statements on that, but I will say just watching the film, the impact of it is incredible. I think it absolutely packs a punch. I think this movie says so much without being very loud about any of the points that it's making. I think that the opening scene of the film and the end of the film, where we kind of catch back up, is fairly straightforward, somewhat obvious, but also I found incredibly powerful. I think the cut to credits here, the closing moments and cut to credits, is kind of masterful. I think it's incredible. I think it absolutely kind of blew me away. So there's a lot to this that really worked. There's parts of this that I don't even know exactly where I land on it, but I think this feels pretty major at first blush, just watching it earlier this evening and trying to get some of these thoughts out of my head about it. It feels like there's a lot to Crimson Gold. That's some of my rambling on it, Jericho. What did you think of Crimson Gold?
Well, Christian, I absolutely loved this movie. For me, this thing captures Iranian society in more up close starkness than really most of the Iranian films that I've seen, but it does it in a very sly way that Panahi does, as you're saying, it's a quiet kind of starkness. Primarily it's a character study of this overweight, mentally ill pizza driver. A big reason this movie works so well for me is just watching this central performance, quote unquote. Hossein, was a paranoid schizophrenic. So on set, unwilling to take direction, disruptive because of his condition. But what comes through here, I think, wherever you fall on that, however you feel about him even being involved in the film, what comes through is a rare thing where a non-actor transcends limitations because he simply shows us the truth. This is not a typical performance. I was reminded of Bruno S. from Herzog Strozek, which I don't know if you've seen that, Christian, but very similar kind of situation with a non-actor, mentally ill person in that. Here, Hussein is just this soft-spoken, mumbling, lumbering, bulking, sad man who's constantly disappointed and let down by society. We know where the story is going, and yet I'm still rooting for Hussein, who's clearly having trouble to find his place. I want him to find his place, even if that means he's just pulling off these small-time grifts with his delivery friend, Ali, who they kind of pal around with, especially at the beginning of the film, kind of like stealing women's purses and whatnot. And Panahi masterfully builds to Hussein's unraveling by using this detached, non-evasive cinematography. Many scenes feature conversations between Hussein and Ali on the back of a motorcycle while the city of Tehran buzzes in the background. It's a location that feels busy. It's overcrowded. It's teeming with activity. But Panahi along with this script by Kiarostami, is suggesting that this is a stifling, dystopian hellhole that prizes the wealthy, the educated, the emotional gnawing at Hussein's private life, the constant feeling that he is less than these wealthier citizens, and the way Iranian society breeds wounded masculinity, kind of low self-esteem. It's all here. It's all in this character study. And Hussein is a troubled, problematic figure, almost in the vein of like a Travis Bickle. If we're actually going to make a Scorsese connection, because you said Goodfellas earlier, but I would say he's much easier to identify with, just in the sense that we do see moments of gentleness and even selfless acts come through. The major example of this is something you referenced, is this prolonged sequence where he's stopped by the police from making a pizza delivery to an apartment where there's a bunch of young people partying, dancing. Hussein is obviously, he's worried about his job. He's understandably frustrated to have to sit here and wait out the night while the police arrest partygoers as they like exit the building. But he strikes up a conversation with this young soldier. He starts distributing pizza to the police officers. And there's this seething intensity under the surface of this guy, but also a willingness to act in the service of others. And Hussein's vacant expression allows us to read into the performance. So like we bring a lot to it based on our own maybe societal experiences, even living in America outside of Iran. But to me, this is one of the saddest characters ever put on film. There's a series of vignettes where he wanders around this rich man's house. You also reference this, even flopping into this indoor swimming pool. And this says so much about the sad inequalities of Iranian society than any like angry monologue or screed ever could. Any sort of dialogue scene, speech would not be able to get across the impact that this one extended series of vignettes show us of him not saying anything, wandering from room to room. I think he does use the guy's stuff and takes a shower and shaves, jumps in the pool. And I mean, that is just incredible filmmaking. It's allowing the audience to do all the work, but there's not really a lot of mental work to do because it's all there. It's all in front of our face.
And
it's
obvious. There's no monologues, and most of the dialogue in this whole sequence is the rich guy who's really just saying kind of inane things. He's, you know, you get one-sided phone conversations and him complaining. I think he calls them sluts, right? Just these two sluts or whatever he just says over and over again. Really unappealing character. But then you have Hussein on the balcony. I think he's in like a robe after he's like swam and shaved and had pizza with this rich guy, you know, drank from his fridge, all this stuff. And then he goes out on the balcony. He's like, oh, I think my house is over there. I think my apartment's over there. And just that is like, it's like an anvil, right? It's just like this huge, it's like this, what he's experiencing now in this building is in the same, like it's in the same geographical area of where he lives. Like, those can be so close to one another and be such vastly different living situations and experiences. Like, that's possible. Like, that's so damning just in that reference, just the idea that Hussein lives nearby. Like, he can see his home from this like palatial estate, is like powerful enough just in that. And it's powerful in the silence as well. But I like that's something that really stuck to me is Hussein says so little in this whole sequence. And then like him choosing to say that being one of the few things he does said just carried so much weight for me.
Yeah. There's just one kind of staggering scene after the other. I mean, there's a scene where him and Ali and Hussein's fiance go to the jewelry store earlier. Yeah. And are trying to pick things out, and that how that sort of cringe, awkward, kind of inequality works out through those conversations and that, and his kind of like, he starts to kind of go into an episode outside of the jewelry store. And I mean, a lesser film, I think, like in that scene specifically that we were talking about at the rich man's house, a lesser film would have had him snap there, maybe kill the guy, something, yeah. Right? You're expecting some form of violence or some form of a freak out there or something, but that doesn't happen. And actually, Hussein doesn't seem that disdainful of the rich guy. Like, he doesn't even seem to be bothered that much by how smug the guy is. He just kind of sits down, eats, walks around this house, takes a dip, you know, and it's just, it's so good, you know, because I think lesser films would have tried to amp this up or would have gone different places that are, I guess, more expected. But I think this is a classic working class zero movie, Christian, following in the footsteps of things like Moonlighting, The Measure of a Man, Sorry We Missed You, even The Bicycle Thieves, stuff like that, right? It also has one of cinema's most fascinating and sad characters. And this performance, I think, by Hussein, is nothing short of astonishing. Maybe it's too real for some people. Maybe it crosses the line. Maybe he shouldn't even have been cast. But what we have here is, I think it's just something that you can't take your eyes off of. And it's because it's in that weird netherworld, that kind of in between acting and non-acting and truth and fiction, mostly truth, but also he was aware he was in a movie, but how aware he was during certain scenes, we don't know what's going on in his brain. So it creates a whole thing, but like the movie is just, to me, this thing really, it just really had an impact on me. And I think it's the best Panahi I've seen, and it's one of the best Iranian films I've seen, and I think it belongs in the same category as other films I referenced, but from this very unique Iranian perspective, of course. And it makes sense why it was, I mean, it's easy to see why it was banned, but it's too bad that not many people have been able to see it until recently. So I'm glad we put it on the docket to review, and it's kind of a tough sell, I think, but you know, we've made some references to other films. I think you'll know if you're listening to this conversation if this is your kind of thing.
Yeah.
Just based on the tenor of our conversation, I think you'll know if you'll get into this. Just don't expect fireworks. Don't expect Scorsese-esque tracking shots.
Right.
You know, this is
That's key. There's not. It is not a flashy movie, and it's not even as frenetic, if that's even fair to bring into the conversation as a descriptor, like that the opening scene might lead you to believe, like that's not even a really an indicator of what the film is going to be as a whole. I will also say, you know, trying to lure anybody into this, it is only 95 minutes. It is streaming, I believe, Mubi, Canopy, and Fandor. So a couple of different like indie type streamers. This is available to watch if you have any of those services. But yeah, I don't know. This is major. And like what you were talking about, and you know, trying to think of other characters to compare this to, things like that, I think that's all fair and justified, but that's what the amount of violence we get in the closing of this film, the amount of violence or lack thereof, I think is such a brilliant decision. Like, it is something I'm like in awe of how the choices that are made and how to depict that, because I think there were plenty of other options on how that could have been done and where the violence is deployed in the runtime of this film, I think is one of its greatest strengths. I don't know. This movie almost feels like too much to even process, considering this guy, the real life Hossein, and knowing to some degree Jafar Panahi, you know, may have struggled to really offer direction. I mean, thinking about that in connection to like that scene of him passing out the pizza to like the soldier and the cops is just like, it's hard for me to even process that, like even like grapple with that, like to what degree was this guy acting, to what degree was there something of that person like that's captured on screen. Like it's almost too much. It's almost like I need to keep it at a distance to a certain degree. I mean, that's part of the question. I think, you know, not unfairly, some people might take issue with some of that as well. But nevertheless, you know, watching this and responding to the impact of this mostly quiet movie, but kind of devastatingly impactful nevertheless, I think that that endures despite any of the other conversations that could happen around this one. Definitely one worth catching up with, Jericho. Yeah.
This is the WoW film, Christian. This is the WoW film. See it in 3D. Dolby Atmos.
Yeah, Dolby Atmos. Get the 4K Blu-ray of this bad boy. All that stuff. All right, I think that's going to do it for episode 196. Panahi and Son, bringing the goods, Jericho. I think we kind of knew that. Not a real surprise here, but... we talked about this a couple weeks back, and I think actually going through these films, talking about them, definitely brought the heat for us.
Every once in a while, we take risks like Elvis and Blonde, but you know we're gonna come back strong with some Panahi, with some foreign cinema. You know, we had to with this one. We knew these films are at least going to be borderline. You know. They're borderline 3-star films just out of the gate, right? So they can only go up. So we needed to go up after Blonde.
And we needed a rebound for sure. Foreign cinema was a salvation for us to a degree. Jericho, I know we're still in this era where we're just kind of bouncing from topic to topic. Maybe we stick with the foreign cinema. There's some other options out there. We could go Decision to Leave. If you're interested in some Park Chan-wook, which I always am, I think I'm the resident Park Chan-wook head around here. That could deliver Decision to Leave. That could be something we do. I don't know. Any thoughts on where we go from here?
Yeah, I'm interested in that one. There's also Don't Judge a Movie by Its Cover, which could come back. Maybe an offshoot, little true. Bonus. Something fun when we're getting towards the holidays. So... we'll figure some stuff out. But there seems to be a lot. We're getting to that time of the year with new releases where things are starting to trickle out that are supposedly supposed to be big deals. But usually, for me at least, end up being turkeys or snoozers because maybe they have some of that Oscar juice behind them. But if there's anything you listeners want us to catch up with, interested in hearing us talk about, please write into the Third Act Podcast at gmail.com. And also... what would you pair with a panini? Give us your thoughts.
Panini and what? Yeah, I know any type of Oscar buzz is a deterrent for you, but I don't know. I would, if you have any interest. I mean, there's other things besides Decision to Leave. I think Tar could elicit a good discussion. I'm interested in that.
What of the Fablemans?
That's a ways off. I think that's December, isn't it?
I was thinking Oscar. That seems like an Oscar-y thing.
Oh, yeah, that's the front runner at this point for Oscars. Is it? The Fablemans. Yeah, no, it is. Yeah, for sure. People are hyped on that one. The Banshees of Inisherin just came out. The new McDonough. Interested in that one. I don't know. I feel like we got some options. We don't have to resort to, you know, anything Blonde-esque, I think, in the near future. I think we have enough options out there floating around that we could land on something more worth our time.
I'm into it.
We'll see how it goes. So that's going to do it. Thanks, Jericho. And listeners, remember that the greatest act of all is the third act of the rest of our lives. Make the best of it and have a good night.